Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Mads.
Thank you for listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. In the next 30 minutes, I'll cut through the noise with interviews, insight and answers from people who make decisions. You will, I hope, leave knowing more than when you arrived. Coming up on the program. Nature is now a balance sheet issue as South Africa unveils a new biodiversity report. A broken immigration system is costing South Africa jobs, skills and investment. Medical aid renewals hit as household budgets reach breaking point. And one drunk post could cost you your job this festive season. It's Tuesday, the 9th of December. South Africa is about to release a massive piece of work that turns nature into a balance sheet item, effectively. The National Biodiversity Assessment shows just how much our economy depends on healthy ecosystems, from farming and fisheries to tourism, mining and insurance. It also warns that degraded rivers, dying wetlands and collapsing water systems now carry real financial risk. Professor Andrew Scono from the National Biodiversity Institute joins us now to explain the findings, the economic stakes and what business and government needs to do next. Professor, a very warm welcome. Let's start with the broad canvas. How bad is the situation? Which ecosystems in South Africa are at critical risk right now?
So the NBA covers a lot of ground, and we have to scan across a multitude of results. And so different users will take different messages and stories out of it, but really hard to avoid noticing the huge impact that we are having on our water systems. That is our rivers, wetlands, how they drain into the sea via our estuaries, and how they affect the coast. These are some of the more stark findings that are coming out of the National Biodiversity Assessment. Indeed, they came out of the previous National Biodiversity Assessment in 2018, so they're not a great surprise.
So if water's a real problem then, Professor, how soon before we see real economic disruption due to ecological decline, or are we already seeing that?
I think many scientists would argue that we're already seeing it. But the conversion of this knowledge about the degradation and the state of our freshwater species and ecosystems, translating that into those measurable economic impacts is difficult and often beyond the purview of many of the scientists involved. So we're seeing extremely clear evidence of these impacts. And in some cases, the economic side is easy to imagine, but the data to support that, the quantifying that, it does remain somewhat of a challenge.
Is it too late to pull things back from the proverbial cliff?
I don't think so. I mean, it would be tough to persist in our endeavors if we felt it was too late. So I think especially with water ecosystems, the aquatic environment is really dynamic. And that dynamicism comes with a slight benefit in that they can recover fairly rapidly from severe modifications and severe impacts because of that dynamicism. In contrast, something like a desert ecosystem, which is incredibly stable, impacts can take thousands of years to recover, whereas our freshwater ecosystems and estuaries have an innate ability to recover, but that would require quite significant changes in management and in changes in the sort of pressures that are operating on these. Those pressures need to be moderated over time, and then we could well see rapid recovery.
Professor, I'm not sure if I'm using the right terminology here, but hear me out. If biodiversity is underpinning the economy, is it fair to ask why it's taken such a long time to effectively put nature on the balance sheet?
A tough question. I guess there are other people who may have a good answer to it. But amongst biodiversity scientists and amongst the biodiversity sector, it's certainly not a new concept. We've been making these arguments for a few decades. It's pretty well understood. But I think their own, in the last 5 years, have been really useful efforts to translate this information into information that is more meaningful to the financial sector, for example, to businesses. So there's a translation. There's been a translation gap, I guess, in terms of this information really hitting home and being interpreted in ways that make sense for business to react and for financial institutions to react. But also, we are seeing global efforts in this regard. So it's almost like a top-down pressure on business and financial institutions to start considering these things more thoroughly and holistically. And that we've really benefited from. So business themselves are pushing for this and financial institutions. We no longer feel like we have to do all the pushing. Mm. They are asking these questions.
All predicated, as you say, on good data. Are you able to tell me which sectors then stand to lose the most money if current trends continue? Would it be agriculture, mining, tourism, or maybe a combination of all of that? I don't know.
Sure. That's another tough question for me, because on the data side, we can tell you the trends, we can show you which ecosystems and species are under the most threat. And there would be a fairly careful reflection required for each sector to really internalize what their risks are. We've explored with some French colleagues in a research paper what we call transition risks to mining would be, because there are many policies in place and regulations that can put mining operations at risk. These are environmental policies that the mining sector have to cope with and deal with. And so we've explored some of this, and we've explored the risks to many industries that are reliant, such as agriculture, on water, and many other industries are reliant on water. We have investigated some of this, and these risks really do seem significant. But there's a lot of work to do at a sectoral level to read the National Biodiversity Assessment, look at the website, and start to use it as some really useful contextual information for them to be able to reflect deeply on the kind of potential risks that they face as a sector and to identify those opportunities.
And just finally, let us not get stuck in a vortex of complete negativity. There, of course, are success stories, are there not?
Absolutely. You know, we've learned the hard way. There's no point in just presenting the negative news and counting the books while the library burns. And so these success stories are a really important part of the National Biodiversity Assessment. We make a big effort to frame these largely negative results, unfortunately, but we frame them in the context of incredible success stories and efforts that are going on that will likely lead to success in the future. So, you know, from spanning a really wide range of topics, from fisheries management success stories with how sea breams, a specific group of fish, have recovered over time due to management. We've looked at, you know, the wildlife sector in South Africa. It's huge. And actually, many of our conservation success stories are coming from the wildlife sector, not just only the conservation sector. Species are recovering due to the wildlife sector, and indeed habitats are being protected. So these stories, really, we do try and leverage, and there are a lot of them. You know, there's a lot of positive news, but we do have to be realistic that overall, environmentally and globally, the news is not great for biodiversity.
Thank you very much indeed, Professor Andrew Scono from the National Biodiversity Institute. I do appreciate your time.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
South Africa's immigration system is, I think, under some degree of renewed scrutiny, not only for who gets in or who gets turned away, but for the economic opportunities we may be losing. The Immigration Amendment Bill, now before Parliament, aims to fix unlawful detentions, inconsistent decisions and backlogs that have trapped skilled applicants in illegal status through no fault of their own. Behind the legal clauses sits a bigger question. If South Africa, if we had a system that was perhaps a little more fair, more efficient and predictable, could immigration actually help drive economic recovery rather than division? In that respect, I'm joined by Candice Magan, who is an immigration specialist and chief executive officer of the company Abroad Scope. Candice, a very warm welcome to you. Maybe let's start with a broad overview. What's the single biggest failure, in your opinion, in the current system that needs to be fixed?
Look, it's not, there's no one single issue. Unfortunately, immigration is incredibly complex. You need to look at the individuals that are coming across the border, who we're trying to attract, and try and build a system that is relevant to the economic framework we're trying to achieve here in South Africa. We need aggressive reform in order to encourage job creation, to fix our economic challenges we have here. And we need to be clever about who and how we attract these foreigners into the country. We're not advocating for free borders, open, you know, movement into the country, but we're saying that there are a lot of people here already contributing to the economy that are finding it very difficult to navigate the immigration process and to follow the procedures. They're erratic, they're forever moving, they're forever changing, and we need to get to a point where we know what we want and we stick to that policy going forward.
Have you put your finger on a cost? In other words, how much economic growth we might be losing because skilled immigrants are stuck in a degree of limbo?
Well, in Leon Schreiber's own admission, you know, with us not having clear policies on how we're going to attract foreigners to the country, we actually turned away a Netflix series that was about to invest 400 million rand into South Africa and give a much needed encouragement to the film industry in South Africa. It left us, it went to Mexico. You know, from that, he's obviously fixed the process of getting into the country. He's made it a little bit easier with the ETA system, but that's now only open for 4 countries at the moment, and that's going to be expanded, and it's a 24-hour process. You can get a visitor's visa to come to the country. Now, I'm saying that's good for tourism, but immigration is a different issue. We are not looking at tourists coming to the country and making it easier for them. We're looking at making it possible for people to invest, to feel secure about their investment, and to make sure that they could drive economic growth to South Africa and that they hold to those processes and procedures and regulations moving forward. It's not just about getting it, making it easier for them to get the first visa, but it's possible, it's making it sure that they deliver on their promises to South Africa, especially those that are wanting to open a business here.
So who do you think is most at risk within the construct of the current system? Would it be asylum seekers? Would it be skilled workers, as you've referred to, or investors?
I think our biggest challenge with those that are seeking asylum in South Africa is that the process for that is also irregular. It's long, it's tedious. And ultimately, you know, you can't put your head in the sand and pretend that these people are not here. They're here. They live here. They school their kids here. They've birthed their children here. They've had funerals here, weddings here. You know, they live here. It's you know, if somebody wakes up at 4 o'clock in the morning and they get on a bus and they go to a job and they do a good job and then they go to church on a Sunday and they are part of a very small part of the economic movement in this country, you can't deny them the right to be here. The bold move and the brave move would be making sure that these people are legal in the country. That way, if you're worried about national security, if you're worried about making it porous, you know, our borders porous, I think giving them a visa, tracking their movements, giving them the possibility to legitimize their status in the country, to bank in South Africa, to own a property in South Africa, and to, you know, operate a business legally in South Africa or work in South Africa legally, then I think, you know what, you're kind of solving the problem of people just...
No, I was going to say the difficulty, if I'm hearing you correctly, is balancing national security with, I guess, compassion and economic opportunity. But how do you respond to South Africans who believe immigration only brings risk and not return?
I think they need to understand that these people are already here. I think the biggest concern that you have is that you don't want to make it easy for more people to cross the border. I understand that. Strengthening our borders is a must. These people are not coming in on the back of food trucks, smuggling themselves into this country. They're walking across the border like everybody else on a daily basis. They are coming here, they're coming here on tourist visas, they're overstaying their visas, and they're getting employment opportunities in South Africa, because it, I think the pressure actually needs to be on the employer in South Africa. I think if we are going to hold anybody accountable, it's the employers that are taking these people and work, like letting them work in the country without the right documentation. You know, if they manage that process correctly and efficiently and make it easier for these people to get employment and to stay employed with one company, you might find that they will do things the correct way. They don't want to do things the wrong way. If you ask any foreigner in coming into South Africa, would you like to rather have a visa? Would you not like to have a visa? I can assure you that majority of them will say, I'd like to do things the right way.
So let's get...
I don't think it's fair to say everybody that's coming into the country is doing things the wrong way. And I don't think national security is an issue of immigration. That's a Justice Department issue.
Candice, let's get back to the economic side of the equation. The skilled applicants that are stuck in limbo, that are having to deal with the backlogs through no fault of their own, are they simply giving up and going elsewhere? We're losing an enormous amount of opportunity with people that we really need.
I think we are. I mean, we looked at our books recently, and we've probably facilitated about 800 million rand investment into this country, all of which have not been easy processes to obtain their visas, be it people wanting to operate a business in South Africa and finding it difficult to go through the phases of Department of Trade and Industry and then getting those endorsements in order to run a business. There are several parameters or several barriers, as put that way, to obtaining the correct visa. I think the perception in South Africa from most South Africans is that we make it easy for people to come to South Africa. I don't think that's the case at all. I think you need to look at the Immigration Act and say, for the longest time, it's been the way it is. In order for us to reach our economic objectives for foreigners coming into the country, we need to relook at that immigration policy and act, and we need to amend it in such a way that it incorporates the investor, it incorporates the people that want to start up a business here, the young entrepreneur. I mean, we have the Nomad visa that's just been launched, but unfortunately that's made no economic difference to South Africa. A Nomad notoriously is somebody that has a very low footprint in the country and has no interest in running a business or working in South Africa. They work for an abroad company and they open their laptop on the beach. You know, this is not somebody that has a massive economic impact. We want entrepreneurs to come to South Africa. We want business visas to come to South Africa to start up businesses. We want foreign businesses to set up call centers here, which the BPO sector has seen a massive increase in job creation in South Africa. It's a big one for us. We have a BPO candidate at the moment who's taken on 260 staff members. His process to getting his visa has been nothing short of a disaster from beginning to end.
I sense this debate is going to continue well into 2026. Candice McGann, thank you very much indeed. Chief Executive Officer of BroadScope, appreciate your time.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
Now, I don't need to tell you that South Africans are under enormous pressure. A new research from Just Money shows that around 16% of people could afford a 10,000 rand emergency. And with medical aid premiums rising by as much as 10% next year, many households are now facing a difficult choice. Downgrade, switch, or go without. As medical aid renewal season opens, Just Money says now is the moment to integrate or interrogate your cover before the costs completely overwhelm your budget. This is a very important conversation to have before the year turns. Erica Liebenberg from Just Money joins me now to explain the findings, the risks, and maybe what practical steps families can take. Erica, it's always good talking to you. Your survey shows 27% of South Africans are insured for medical costs. That is very, very few. It's a looming national crisis, isn't it?
It absolutely is. And in fact, on average, about 30 out of 20 South Africans has access to a medical scheme or had access to a medical scheme in 2023. And in fact, we're expecting that number to plummet, because if the tax credit removal goes ahead as planned, then there's an estimated 2 million people who are going to lose access to a medical aid, whether as a primary member or a beneficiary. So yes, definitely a looming national crisis.
Premiums, as I mentioned at the start of the conversation, going up as by as much as 10%. I suppose it's an obvious question, but which groups are most at risk of completely falling out of the system?
Lower income groups, obviously, you know, when your budget is stretched and any insurance is a grudge spend, medical aid is often one of the first things to go because the expense attached can seem enormous. And, you know, there are other options we can talk about, but quite often those who run risk of falling away are the ones who can least afford it because, you know, the public health system is overtaxed, I think we all know. And there are wait lists, queues and backlogs for serious treatments, including cancer, surgical procedures. I mean, we've all heard horror stories about people with things like appendicitis being in a corridor for 3 days for want of a surgeon, you know, or even a bed. And that is the reality. So those who really cannot not afford to be unwell, you know, particularly blue collar workers, you know, they cannot afford a day off work, but at the same time, they cannot afford medical aid. And so they're sitting in that no man's land of, you know, being at severe risk. But in truth, no South African can afford to fall away from the medical aid at this point in terms of the way the public health system is coping.
And no one wants to be in that no man's land. And you suggest that planning can avoid overspending. Erica, what are the most common mistakes then that people make when choosing a plan or deciding on their options?
The main thing is, you know, we always say a failure to plan is planning to fail. It's a cliche, but it's true. The most important thing to do is to really carefully consider if you do have a medical aid at the moment, have a look what is changing in 2026. Have a look at what the premium increase is going to be. And then have a look at other plan options. It may be that you can downgrade slightly and still cover most of your risk if you can't afford to cover all of your risk. So failure to plan is a big one, and failure to look through that documentation. It's also a really good idea to get your broker involved, because the fact of the matter is that a part of your medical aid fee does include a broker fee. A lot of people are surprised to learn that. A lot of people have contacted schemes directly and initiated their own cover. But the truth of the matter is you're paying for a broker, so appoint one. If you don't know who your broker is, you know, find a broker, ask around and appoint that person and enlist their support in helping you to work out what's going to change and where you might be able to downgrade. The other crucial thing is have a look at your medical expenses over the past 12 months and consider how they might have changed. So, for example, you might be planning a family, you may have developed a chronic condition. So that's really crucial to have a look at, you know, plan ahead and make sure those costs are going to be covered. And we always say, and you know, to Jeremy, that this is the window for downgrades. Upgrades can be done at any time of the year. Try to stay within your own medical scheme rather than switching between schemes if you can. If you can find an option that allows you to stay within your current scheme, because if you switch schemes, there may be waiting lists or waiting periods imposed, even if you've enjoyed uninterrupted coverage, and that can catch you out. So, you know, better the devil you know, in a sense. So try to stay within your scheme and take out gap cover. It's absolutely crucial.
Let's talk about gap cover in a moment, but I want, there is a counter argument, I think, to what you're telling me, but maybe you'll disabuse me of the notion. People say that medical insurance is cheaper, but it doesn't necessarily cover prescribed minimum benefits. Explain that to me and how many people misunderstand that difference.
Yeah, quite right, Jeremy. In fact, it doesn't at all cover PMBs, because those are required to be covered by medical aid providers by law, but that doesn't apply to insurance, medical insurance. Look, it is a great deal cheaper to take out medical insurance. Even the most premium medical insurance is going to be cheaper than the least expensive medical aid. However, it's structured very, very differently. You know, where a medical aid is going to cover you at least for hospital, you know, that's kind of your minimal medical aid plan, if you like, is a hospital plan. And it's going to cover you for up to 100% or more of the medical aid rate. A medical insurance won't necessarily cover you for that. It'll cover you for specific needs like day-to-day GP visits or dental treatments. It might cover you for limited hospital procedures. It might even cover you for casualty visits. However, it tends to pay out a set cash amount for specific needs. And if you end up in ICU, I can guarantee you your medical insurance is not going to be adequate. For that, you're going to need a medical aid. And you're going to need to check the limitations on your medical aid in terms of what percentage of the medical aid rates it actually covers. Because sometimes, you know, for example, anaesthetists or specialists can charge up to 700% of medical aid rates. And if you're on a medical aid, you can take out gap cover. You cannot do that with insurance. So when we say prescribed minimum benefits, we're talking about things like, even if you have a hospital plan and let's say you fall and you break your wrist, obviously your emergency and hospital treatment is going to be covered. But because a broken wrist is also prescribed minimum benefit, you're also going to be covered for rehab outside of the hospital setting. You know, you're going to be covered for ongoing treatment. So that's where medical insurance is probably not going to be able to help you out.
Erica, just a quick one on gap cover. As you've said, it can help, but many people don't buy it. Is it because they don't understand it or simply because we can't afford it?
I think it's probably a bit of both, but I always recommend go for the least expensive gap cover if that's all you can afford. It's important to note because, I mean, that can be a few hundred rand. So if you're already paying out, you know, 4, 5, 6, 10,000 rand for your family, that extra few hundred can seem impossible. But here's the thing. If your practitioner, you know, is charging 200, 300, 400 times the medical aid stipulated rate, and that happens much more often than we think, you are going to be left with a significant shortfall that you weren't expecting. The extra few hundred grand is absolutely worth it. Shop around, have a look at what, you know, it's not a huge additional amount to pay. And quite often your gap cover, it's important to note, it's only going to cover the shortfall that your medical aid won't pay. So if you have a hospital plan and you want to go to the GP and your medical aid is not going to pay for that, neither is your gap cover. It's also important to note that there is a limit of 219,845 rand per person on gap cover. So if you're in ICU, your medical aid only covers up to 100%. Your gap cover can only cover about an additional 220,000 per person per year if there's a severe and catastrophic event. So be aware of that limitation. But it is absolutely worth having that gap cover because one instance of payout from a gap cover, even for a less serious thing, you know, you're not in ICU, you weren't in a catastrophic accident or you didn't have a serious illness, but that one instance can be all you need to have, in a sense, covered your gap cover bill for that entire year. I almost think it's kind of low-key crazy to have medical aid and not have gap cover.
Some good advice as we enter 2026. Erica Liebenberg from Just Money Communications, I do appreciate your time.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
As the festive season gets underway, South Africans, fair to say, will be posting from beaches, braais and holiday parties. But experts are warning one reckless post could cost you your job in January. A recent court case confirming that off-duty racist comments on social media can lead to dismissal, even if they're made on leave. Jonathan Goldberg from Global Business Solutions, he's been on our program before, joins me now to explain how far employers can go, where the legal lines are, and what workers need to know before they hit post. Jonathan, a very warm welcome. Nice to talk to you again. Can someone really be fired from a post made on holiday outside working hours?
Good day to you all. Yes, the law has been quite clear in that in respect to the court cases since 2019 where a Edcon employee posted late one night watching the news that the government were monkeys running this country. And clearly the monkey post came from the Penny Sparrow issue in Durban, and that person was fired because members of the public took umbrage about that, and that person was dismissed. The CCMA arbitrator did not agree that the dismissal was appropriate. The Labour Court confirmed dismissal being appropriate. So, again, I think we know that we shouldn't do these posts. The posts go further. You know, the new Employment Act talks about harassment. So anything that's sexist, demeaning, that you do post and you say, well, I am the chairman of Global Business Solutions or I work for Edcon or I work for whoever, that's a problem. So people need to understand that. I think employers also need to do more and more to educate people that they shouldn't, after a couple of drinks or after smoking something, we're allowed to smoke now at our own homes, our private dwellings, that they shouldn't be posting these issues and to think very carefully about what they post and how people would react to that. I think that's very important to try get people to understand the consequences so you can prevent as much of this as possible.
Where exactly is the legal line, or has that legal line changed, Jonathan, between free speech and hate speech in the workplace?
I don't think the legal line is there anymore. I think if you do work for an organization that's got a value system, I think that value system goes with you even to the household braai. And I think that's what people don't understand. They say, well, we're anti-racist at work, but around the braai we're racist. If that's picked up or recorded, as we see today, I think you're in big trouble. And I think we need to educate people that we can't have these statements that we are free of discrimination, racism at the workplace, only to find that after a couple of beers, then you sort of change character. I think that line is becoming more and more unblurred. In other words, there's one continuum. You work for this organization, you carry its values. And you think about, Jeremy, you've done a lot of work on branding, how much money these organizations spend on branding their reputation. And again, one post goes viral, and that's that brand damaged. And again, it affects sales directly.
So let's talk about that then. If a post does go viral, how quickly must an employer act to avoid any kind of reputational damage? Sooner rather than later, obviously.
Yes, and we also see in many organizations in South Africa, parastatals, government, and even private enterprise, they're just too slow to act. And again, I think for me, it starts with education of people, education of employees at all levels to understand the implications of doing this, and then effectively to say, because it ties back to the values. It's interesting, Jeremy, what's been happening a lot in the social media, specifically after the Coldplay cam, is this issue around senior executives having affairs at work with the people that work with them too. And we've seen a number of senior dismissals where the standard higher up is even more. You expected the higher up you go in the organization to even have a higher standard of degree of care to that organization.
Are companies themselves liable if an inflammatory post is linked to them, either through tagging or profile information?
So not unless they don't take action. So again, I think the vicarious liability clause comes in Section 60 of the Employment Equity Act. I think if you take action, you can't be liable at all. Unless the person's acting on behalf of the company, and generally that's not the case. But it's the brand and damage to the sales and reputation of those organizations that we're going to keep on. And again, living the value system. We can't be having these value and these wonderful statements in the workplace and not living them. I think that's the contradiction, that we move into an era where people are saying, well, does this organization really stand for this?
Just in terms of employees, let's assume they've done it. What rights would they then have to defend themselves before any disciplinary action, I guess, when they return to work in January?
Yes. So, the current law is for big businesses. The Code of Good Practice has now been amended. It's simpler for smaller businesses. But for big companies would be, you charge a person that have a full disciplinary inquiry. And, proper disciplinary inquiry doesn't have to last for days and days. It's a simple charge. You posted this, your own staff members have complained, your fellow employees have complained, or members of the public. You've got a copy of the post. Did you know about it? It's a quick inquiry, really. Take 2 or 3 hours, and the outcome of that would be then potentially the person's guilty. The appropriate penalty would be, in most cases, dismissal. And the person would have the right to refer the matter to the CCMA or bargaining council that has jurisdiction.
Just a final one, Jonathan. As far as employers are concerned and the monitoring of social media, obviously there would be tracking accounts. Are there rules around that, and how actively should they be doing it?
I think there are rules around that. So I think that's personal information. But again, it doesn't become personal information when you've got 5,000 Facebook followers and you've called your own employees, the people that work with you, the members of the public who support that organization. So that's where it goes. That's where it goes pear-shaped. And often it's not about at all about the company having to track it. Employees and members of the public track these things and react to them quite quickly.
Jonathan Goldberg, as always, thanks for the insight from Global Business Solutions. I appreciate your time. And on that note, we are going to leave it. You've been listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. We are here every weekday at noon with the latest in current affairs, the economy and policy. You can always catch the podcast version a little later. Thank you for making us part of your day. Until next time, goodbye.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at midday or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts and Spotify, or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.